Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org. Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of InForum, the Commonwealth Club's Innovation Lab. You can find InForum online at inforumsf.org. I'm Clara Jeffrey, co-editor of Mother Jones, and tonight's event is Matt Taibbi, A Scathing Portrait of American Injustice. Matt is an author and former contributing editor for Rolling Stone magazine, who is now spearheading a magazine for Pierre Omidyar's First Look Media. While best known for christening Goldman Sachs a great vampire squid wrapped around the face of humanity, Matt has written critically about many politicians and institutions that shape our country's collective experience. From his book Griftopia, a fierce debunking of big banks and their lapdogs, to The Great Derangement, a dystopic examination of the post-9/11 era, Taibbi passionately decries systemic corruption and societal injustice. His new book, The Divide, American Injustice at the Age of the Wealth Gap, is an examination of who's too big to jail and who's too poor to get justice. We're so pleased to have him here with us tonight to discuss the divide, so let's get to it. Matt, you start The Divide by unearthing the story of the Holder Memo, which is pretty obscure. So tell us what it is and how did it come to play a role in the financial crisis?
So the Holder Memo, way back in, do I get to use the gavel at any point?
No, maybe, if you're lucky.
So the Holder Memo goes back to the late 90s when Eric Holder, who was back then just an official in the Bill Clinton Justice Department, he wrote a memo which has come to be known as the Holder Memo, which was originally sort of thought of as a kind of get tough on crime document. The memo basically provided federal prosecutors with guidelines that they could use to go after white-collar offenders. And most people at the time paid more attention to the tough aspects of this memo. Among other things, it allowed prosecutors to say to corporate offenders that we will only give you credit for cooperation if you do things like waive privilege, which was a powerful tool that federal prosecutors had never had before. And so for years, this was actually thought of as an anti-business document. But at the bottom of the Holder Memo, there was this little addendum, and it outlined something called the collateral consequences policy. And all collateral consequences really said was that if you are a prosecutor and you're going after a big, systemically important company that maybe employs a lot of people, and you, the prosecutor, are concerned that there may be innocent victims if you proceed with a criminal case against this company, for instance, shareholders or executives who had no role in the wrongdoing, then you may seek alternative remedies apart from criminal prosecutions. In other words, fines, deferred prosecution agreements, non-prosecution agreements. All he was really saying is you don't necessarily have to criminally prosecute when you have a big company that's done something wrong. And this is a completely sensible policy. It makes a lot of sense. It even makes a lot of sense now. The problem is that when he returned to office as Attorney General, he came back to a world that was populated by this new kind of corporate offender, the too big to fail bank, which was basically exactly the kind of company that collateral consequences could have been created for. And a lot of these companies had done a lot of very shady things. And collateral consequences provided the government with a way to proceed that didn't involve criminal prosecutions. It just sort of gave the government an excuse to not go forward. And furthermore, even though the intent of this doctrine was to prevent prosecutions against companies, they've begun to conflate it and also not proceed against individuals at the companies as well, which I don't think was the original intent of the Holder Memo. But that seems to have been its legacy now, because we've seen a series of settlements where they haven't proceeded against either companies or the individuals working at the companies.
So do you think it's a symbol of that mentality, or is it an actual factor in the decisions not to prosecute, to fine, and due to delayed prosecutions?
I think it's a combination of both, actually. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, the existence of the Holder memo, first of all, it was gathering dust for years. After Bill Clinton left office, people forgot about that memo for a long time until there was an event. It was the collapse of Arthur Anderson. Everyone remembers, of course, this Big Six accounting firm that played a role in the Enron scandal. They were accused of shredding 2 tons of documents. The government proceeded with a single felony count against the company. The company went under, 27,000 jobs were lost, and politicians everywhere freaked out. And basically, there was a general consensus in the law enforcement community that we will never again proceed against a company in this fashion if we can avoid it. And that was really when collateral consequences was sort of dusted off and reborn again. And Arthur Anderson was really just a precursor to the decisions that we made with regard to companies after 2008 that had done, I would argue, far worse things, but they were just as systemic. They were even more systemically important than Arthur Anderson was.
So there's an argument to be made, like there have been some massive fines, right? Some mm-hmm. ginormous fines. And trials can be lengthy and super expensive, and sure. Who knows what's going to happen. So what do you think is the argument against just going the fine route rather than even trying to prosecute some of these folks?
So this is a super important question, because in a vacuum, a lot of this approach of very high fines coupled with strict deferred prosecution agreements where they may impose certain conditions on the company, in a vacuum, that may make a lot of sense. It may seem like the best possible resolution. The state doesn't have to waste 5, 6, 7 years trying to prosecute a company, and you don't have to beat back thousands of motions, and you don't have to worry about perhaps losing a case where you have to expend enormous resources in the first place. And so it does make a kind of sense. But the problem is that it falls apart when you think about who doesn't have the option to just buy their way out of jail. And this actually gets to the whole reason why I wrote this book. And here I should sort of make a confession that when I decided to write this book, this was right around the time of the Occupy protests. And ironically, the financial crisis had actually been kind of a boon to my career. before 2008, I was sort of a typical political, I guess you would say, humorist. I sort of made fun of politicians for a living. That was really all I did. And I had this existential crisis about whether or not that work was valuable at all. And then I got assigned to cover the financial crisis and the causes of it. And I started doing these stories, and I discovered this whole complicated world of things that I never knew about underneath, and I had to study. And I was doing these pieces where I was basically translating these very complicated and elaborate scams and trying to help broad audiences understand what had happened in 2008. And I felt like this was a really worthwhile endeavor. But it was really just sort of an intellectual exercise. I got a charge out of the challenge of deciphering these things and translating it for audiences. And so when it came time, I had finished this book, Cryptopia, which had, you know, had done fairly well. And so I was getting offers to write another book, and I was trying to think of what I would write about next. And it occurred to me that I should write about the fact that nobody was going to jail. And I somewhat cynically, I thought, this is going to be easy, you know, because morally, this is totally indefensible. And all I'll have to do is tell a few stories about people who had done terrible things and got away with it, and boy, will that make people angry, and it'll sell a lot of books, and that'll be easy. And then I started to just to do my due diligence. I decided to look into who does go to jail in America and why, and I started to become overwhelmed by all these horrible, horrible stories of injustices that were being done to ordinary people who didn't have money. I mean, one of the first days I went out, I heard of a story about a 13-year-old mentally disabled African-American boy in Brooklyn who had been picked up by a couple of cops, and they threw him in the back of a squad car and told him that he couldn't go home that day until he helped them find an illegal gun. And so he ended up telling them that there was a gun at his grandmother's house, and they descended upon that kid's grandmother's house. They hauled in the grandmother. They hauled in the kid. They hauled in the kid's brother. I mean, it's terrible. I heard story after story, you know, a woman who gets arrested, undocumented immigrant in Los Angeles who gets arrested for driving without a license, and she's sentenced to 170 hours of community service and a $1,700 fine. And she has to take her kids to the community service every night. She's crying herself to sleep every night. Another undocumented, I'm sorry to repeat all these stories, but the point was I was overwhelmed, like emotionally overwhelmed by all of these stories of people who were doing time, who were thrown in jail for varying degrees of absurdity. And it struck me that there's no way to talk about whether or not this collateral consequences policy is justified until you actually look in the mirror and ask yourself, do you really know who's going to jail in this country, and why are people going to jail in this country? And a lot of people just don't know. I mean, I was living my life happily, not knowing that all of these people were being arrested. But it's morally indefensible when somebody can pay a fine and get out of $1 billion theft while other people are doing 2 or 3 years in jail for reaching into a cash register in a liquor store. It's a very long-winded answer, but the whole point is you have to look at the two things side by side in order to evaluate the policy, and that's what they don't do. They when officials just defend these policies, they never they deny the idea that there's any connection between the two problems.
Backing up for a sec to the difference even in the way that, say, bankers were treated and homeowners were treated, can you talk a little bit about moral hazard, what it means, and I think you know where I'm going.
Yeah, of course. Of course. No, this is outrageous. Everybody's heard this term moral hazard, right? And this is the idea that, you know, after the financial crisis in 2008, we had all these people who were headed into foreclosure. I think at one point it was 4 million people who were in, you know, either in foreclosure or headed for foreclosure. And the argument emanating from Wall Street during this time was that to provide assistance to these people in the form of any kind of a bailout would encourage irresponsibility, because these people had taken on more debt than they could handle, and that was their fault, and they should take responsibility for their actions, and it would be just encouraging more bad behavior if we provided any assistance to those people. And in some cases, the people who were making that argument were exactly the same people who were taking gigantic bailouts from the United States government. I mean, the example I like to cite is Charlie Munger from Berkshire Hathaway, who very famously said that people in foreclosure should suck it in and cope. And meanwhile, his company was a major investor in Wells Fargo, which was a recipient of TARP money. And he didn't seem to complain too much about getting TARP money. He didn't think that was a moral hazard, but he did think it was a moral hazard for people who were in foreclosure. And this is what's so funny about this is that if you talk to people on Wall Street, they very often just literally, they don't see the hypocrisy of that. It's a very strange thing.
Who surprises you most who's not, if not in jail, at least been prosecuted or come close to a trial date amongst the Wall Street crew? Like, is there a specific example that you think, wow, I can't believe these people didn't go to trial?
Well, let's talk about Countrywide, for instance, okay? No, of course, there was a case. There was an SEC case involving Angela Mozilla, the creator of Countrywide. Now, Countrywide nearly blew up the entire world, and the innovation of this company was basically that they were going to give a loan to anything with a pulse, This was part and parcel of the whole scam that underlined the entire subprime mortgage crisis, and it was a very crude fraud scam. Actually, it was just dressed up in a lot of camouflaging jargon. Basically, banks lent billions of dollars to companies like Countrywide, who in turn went out to poor and middle class neighborhoods, gave loans out to everybody that they could find. I talked to one former mortgage broker who worked for a company like Countrywide, who used to go to 7-Elevens at night and hang around the beer cooler, and that was how he found clients to give mortgages to. Anyway, they would go out and they would create these gigantic masses of loans, and it didn't matter how much, whether the people had enough income to pay. It didn't matter whether they were citizens, whether they had identification, whether they were real people at all, whatever. They created the loans, they sold them back to the banks, the banks pooled the loans, they chopped them up into securities, and then they more or less instantly turned around and sold these securities to institutional investors like pension funds, foreign hedge funds, foreign trade unions. In other words, it was this giant scam. You had people who thought they were buying AAA-rated real estate here in the United States. In fact, they were buying the home loans of extremely risky home borrowers here in the U.S. And Countrywide was at the center of this whole thing. I mean, I talked to a whistleblower from Countrywide. He was hired to be part of their quality control team, of all things. And he tells a story of pulling into the parking lot to meet with Angelo Mozzillo and his lieutenants. And he sees there's a fancy car in the parking lot that has a personalized license plate that says Fundum. And when he asked about it, they're basically like, yeah, we give mortgages to everybody who asks. And their irresponsibility nearly blew up the entire international financial system. And Angelo Mozzillo made about $500 million working at Countrywide, and he was fined by the SEC, something on the order of $49 million. Most of which was covered by an insurance policy by Bank of America, which by then had acquired Countrywide. So he ended up out of his pocket only paying about $1 million, $2 million. And he walked away with something like $400 million that he got to keep. And he's not doing any time. And to me, that's an example of the kind of person that they're, you know, he's the patient zero of the financial crisis. And not only does he not do time, he gets to keep all of his money, too.
Are there any reforms that have come about that you feel optimistic about?
I do. I think there is some momentum, especially in the Senate, for breaking up too big to fail banks. It's an idea that was brought up first during the Dodd-Frank hearings. You might recall the Brown-Kaufman Amendment, where
who doesn't?
But the idea basically was just to, you know, if a bank was, you know, physically exceeded certain parameters, they had to break up into smaller pieces, because otherwise they posed a hazard in the sense that if they got in trouble again, we would have to, A, have to bail them out, and B, there was the problem that they were unprosecutable, because once they were as big as they are now, collateral consequences comes into play. We can't move against a company like a Chase or a Wells Fargo or a Goldman Sachs or a Morgan Stanley, because they've just become too big and too unmanageable. And Brown-Kaufman was routed during the Dodd-Frank amendment, Dodd-Frank negotiations. It was something on the order of it was 60 something to 30 something. But there's been movement on both sides of the aisle. And people like Sherrod Brown have succeeded in convincing, slowly but surely, members of both in Republicans and Democrats, that this too big to fail problem is just untenable. And also, there's been a lot of support from the heads of the local Federal Reserve banks, who've also been saying that this problem has to change and that this is creating a terrible moral hazard. So I do think that, well, it's probably going to take another disaster, but after that disaster happens, I think that we'll probably end up breaking up some of those companies, and I think that'll be important.
Okay, so bankers, you know, clearly can't go to jail. Who does? Why is crime down, but the prison population is, you know, five times what it was 20 years ago?
I asked that question of so many people, and the answer I kept getting was it's a statistical mystery. Nobody really knows why crime started to go down in the early 90s in the United States, but it has. It's plunged. Violent crime has plunged something on the order of 44% since 1990, and it's across the board. It's in all regions of the United States, cities, rural areas. It doesn't matter. Crime is just down. Some people ascribe it to the aggressive statistics-based policing strategies like broken windows, the whole idea that we're no longer going to turn a blind eye to things like fair beating or, you know, fair jumping or jaywalking, and we're going to pick up everybody who does every little thing. And that's been a cornerstone of policing in, for instance, New York City, where I live. Last year in New York City, they issued 600,000 summonses for things like riding the wrong way down a sidewalk on your bicycle. That was 20,000 summonses. There were 80,000 for open container violations, 50,000 for marijuana, which actually is technically not even, it's been technically decriminalized in New York since 1977. But they use a trick to arrest people for that one. As long as you keep your marijuana in your pocket in New York, they're not supposed to be able to arrest you. But stop and frisk and basically other forms of policing have allowed cops basically to profile people and ask them to empty their pockets. And then as soon as they empty their pockets and take their weed out of the pocket, then it's open and it's in public view, and then that's a crime. So you have somebody who's obeying the law and is being lawful, and 50,000 times last year they took those people and they turned them into people who had to answer marijuana summonses and go to court for that. I don't personally believe that that's the reason why crime is going down, but I do think that that's a big reason why the prison population is going up.
So what does sending people to jail for low-level possession or jaywalking do?
Well, it can have all kinds of consequences for, you know, personally, not just for that person, but for that person's family. I mean, a great example is one that's in the book that involved a couple of guys in Harlem, Michael McMichael and Anthony Odom. They were basically arrested for driving a nice car, for being black and driving a nice car in Harlem. Actually, it was the Bronx. And the police... The police told them that the probable cause was they had smelled the odor of marijuana emanating from their car, even though this was winter and the windows were rolled up and the police had stopped them, you know, had spotted them from blocks away. And they pulled these guys over. And the reason they pull in all these people is because they're looking for two things. They're looking for guns or warrants, right? And then that's how cops get promoted. They find guns or they catch fugitives. And so they're just they're rolling the dice, figuring that a couple of black guys in a nice car, they're going to find one or the other. Well, these guys were innocent, as it turned out. But rather than let them go, they cooked up this marijuana possession charge. There were no drugs in the car, but they said they smelled the odor. Because of that, because these guys had this ridiculous charge hanging over their heads, one of them, Anthony, who was applying for a job at the MTA, to be a subway operator, he lost his chance at that job because you're not allowed to apply for a city job if you have a drug charge hanging over you. A lot of times, if you get arrested for a drug charge, your relatives might lose their Section 8 housing. If you get arrested for welfare fraud, you are forever barred from asking for any other forms of public assistance. I mean, again, we talk about collateral consequences for banks and what the consequences might be for shareholders, but there's all kinds of consequences for individuals every time they're arrested. And for some reason, we don't have to consider that, but we do have to consider it for the other kind of offender.
You and I talked a little bit in the green room about bail, who gets it, and what happens if you don't get it, which... has some pretty profound effects on future employment statistically and, you know, the ability to keep rent and so forth. So can you just talk a little bit about how that industry and just other industries are sort of picking at the carcass, really, of the sort of criminal justice system?
Sure. Well, first of all, there's this amazing trick that I learned about that involves bail in New York. Well, it's not just in New York. It happens in many different states. But it's there's a saying in a lot of courts, if you go in, you stay in. If you get out, you stay out, which basically means that if you make bail, you're probably going to beat the case. If you don't make bail, you're going to lose the case. And what happens... in New York, especially, if you're charged with a misdemeanor, for instance, and you don't make bail, They have a speedy trial law rule in New York where they're supposed to either drop the case or bring you to trial within 90 days, but there's a trick that the state is allowed to use to evade that restriction. And what they do is when you have a court date, the prosecutors will show up in court and they'll say to the judge, I actually saw this happen, they'll say to the judge, Your Honor, we're not ready to proceed today. One of our witnesses is missing or whatever it is. And the judge, of course, who's the calendars in these courts are always horribly overscheduled and overstuffed, and he'll look at his calendar and say, well, the next time we can meet is 2.5 months from now, so let's write in a date for then. And so everybody goes home, and of course the defendant is miserable because now he knows he's not going to have a hearing for at least 2.5 more months. But the very next day, what happens is the prosecutor files what he calls a certificate of readiness, which basically means that while I wasn't ready to proceed yesterday, I am ready to proceed today. And the prosecutor knows that they're not going to reschedule the court date for that day, that the next available hearing is 2.5 months from now. So instead of charging the prosecutor for 65 or 70 days towards that 90-day restriction, they only charge it for 1 day. And in this fashion, a person can be sitting awaiting trial for a misdemeanor, not for 90 days, but for a year, 2 years, even more. And as a result, if you don't make bail, what ends up happening is the prosecutors will come to you and they'll say, look, we got you, and we're going to offer you a deal, time served plus 10 days. You should either take that or leave it. And 9 times out of 10, people take it because the alternative is you might end up serving 3 or 4 or 5 times as much time waiting for trial as you would if you were sentenced. And this is why bail is so critical. And, of course, bail is a non-factor in white-collar crimes, unless if you're charged with anything short of multiple homicide, you're going to be able to get out on bail for almost anything. And so it's just an issue that is not talked about very much. And of course, there's the commercial aspect of it, too, where there are companies that are making enormous sums of money on these people who are stuck in the system and are forced to go to bail bondsmen to get money to get out. And it's not a coincidence. I witnessed this myself many times. Lawyers have a term for an amount of money that judges will set for bail that is just barely too much for the defendant to afford and just too little for a bail bond company to be interested in giving out. They call it nuisance bail, and it's this little sweet spot that the defendants can't afford to pay. Over and over again, you'll see somebody who only has $300 in assets get a $400 bail. That's how people end up in jail. And then of course, through all these other tricks, they end up pleading to these cases.
I was telling Matt that the commercial bail industry was actually founded here in San Francisco. And it was called the nickname of it was the Old Lady of Kearney Street, which is right around the corner, and it was the fountainhead of corruption, so declared in a sort of Serpico-level bust of the police department back in the 30s. It was pretty bad. It's an interesting
Yay,
topic.
San Francisco.
Yay. Nowhere else in the world really has commercial bail. We made that happen. There has been positive movement on some of this front. There's, rolling back the mandatory minimums, rolling back 3 strikes in some mm-hmm. cases, de Blasio putting the kibosh on stop and frisk. Like, conservatives are kind of leading the way in prison and sentence reform in some states because it's a fiscal issue. It's just too expensive. It just, they took a look at the numbers and actually doesn't make sense.
Right.
What do you think is behind, is this a sort of collective awakening? Has it just gotten so big that we can't afford it, literally, and now the numbers?
Yeah, that might, I'm sure ultimately the finances play the key role in that whole situation. I mean, with 3 strikes, I think the morality of it was the key factor. It's just totally indefensible. One of the cases I covered was somebody who got sentenced to life for stealing a pair of $2.50 tube socks. That's politically indefensible, no matter what you think about crime. So, but I do think that the progress is maybe overstated a little bit, because even in New York, where stop and frisk is allegedly being rolled back, I talk to people in neighborhoods like Bedford-Stuyvesant, and they say that they'll just come up with some other way of stopping people on the street. You know, they'll figure out some other way of emptying pockets, and they'll say that they saw something, a bulge in your pocket, or that they saw you conducting a transaction with a friend, and who's going to argue with the probable cause listed in a summons? I mean, it takes a lot of energy to overturn, to even investigate those cases, and I just don't have a. I think it's always going to be politically popular to bang on crime committed in inner cities. And as a result of that, we're always going to have high prison populations from those areas until I think there's a larger awakening to the injustices that are being done.
You're known for your zingers, particularly your vampire squid line about Goldman Sachs. And I'm curious, just as a writer, did you know, like when you wrote that line, did you know, wow, this is gold. This is going to be the one.
No. No, not at all. No, I originally, first of all, it was like really late at night, and I stuck it in the bottom of the piece, and it was the editors who put it up at the top. You never know what lines are going to stick and which ones aren't. For a while, one of the reasons why I had to use a lot of that kind of language is because this subject matter is so dry and so inaccessible to people that you have to use every trick in your literary arsenal to sex it up for people. And one of the things that you especially have to do is try to have fun with things like physical descriptions of people, and to use fiction writing techniques in order to try to sort of play up the black hat versus white hat aspects of things. And I've been criticized for that, for over-dramatizing certain things. And in some cases, I think the criticisms are justified. But the problem is, the trade-off is if you don't do that, then people aren't going to pay attention at all, and they won't be interested in it. So there's a fine line that you have to walk between, how much color you have to use in these kinds of stories, and how closely you have to stick to just the facts.
What was the hardest part for you to sort of slog your way through in understanding either the fiscal crisis or the criminal justice system? Like, what took the longest to derivatives or?
Oh, yeah, it was all that stuff. I mean, are you kidding? I mean, at the beginning, I remember, first of all, I remember the first time when I started to read about the financial crisis. It was after the Sarah Palin speech. It was September 3rd, 2008. I was at the convention, and I was in the filing room, and after her speech, and I was just about to write up her thing, and I'm looking on the internet, and I'm seeing that the world is ending, basically, and I turned to a reporter next to me, and I'm like, dude, have you noticed, like, the economy is melting down, and what's a subprime mortgage? Do you understand any of this stuff? And he looked at me, and he goes, like that. Like that was his whole reaction. Like, it wasn't even worth looking into. And so I was so worried about this because we don't know anything about the economy and it's blowing up before our eyes. But everybody I talked to just spoke in that impenetrable jargon, and it's really, really difficult to get a read on it. And it wasn't until I would call up people and I would say, tell me something about something. That's how desperate I was in the beginning. I would randomly call up analysts, cold call them, and just say, tell me something understandable. And it wasn't until I found a guy who basically made cartoons about Goldman Sachs who sat me down and he walked me through some very basic things about how subprime mortgages worked and how collateralized debt obligations worked. And, and once I got the basics of it, but it took me, I would say, 3 months. I mean, it's like learning a language. I mean, until you... If for anybody who studied a foreign language, there's that moment where you feel like you can actually converse with people, and that it takes a while,
And do you feel like you will always have that fluency, or do you worry like, oh, I'm getting a bit rusty on what's the CDO again?
Well, one of the problems is that they're constantly coming up with new innovations. So if you're not paying attention, God knows what they're going to come up with next, and it's very difficult to stay on top of. And so I'm frequently, like for instance, just recently there's this huge scandal in the the foreign exchange markets, so I have to learn all about currencies, which I'd never had to do before. And a few months ago, I had to do a thing on metals prices, and so you have to learn about the metals markets. But that's the job. I mean, that's what journalism is. You have to go from zero to, we're basically like professional test crammers, right? I mean, that's what it is. You have to get up to speed on something you know nothing about, by Friday morning, and when you start on Thursday night.
Your pieces can seem very fueled by rage. I mean, sometimes, at least back in the day, maybe fueled by some other stuff as well. But always there's a level of fury there, I think. And I'm wondering how that helps you propel yourself through a piece, and also does it sometimes make you feel like, wait, I have to feel on my own personal level like a sense of hope, and what is that thing that you're hopeful about?
Well, I think it's important for a journalist to have a sense of outrage about things. In fact, this is one of the things that motivated me to kind of move in a certain direction with my career. I started off a long, long time ago. I worked for a newspaper in Moscow called the Moscow Times, and it was your basic expatriate newspaper. Everybody wrote in AP style, that kind of sort of very careful third-person prose. And we would be writing about things that were on sort of epic scandals, like the Loans for Share scandal, which was basically a thing where a bunch of Boris Yeltsin's buddies privatized the jewels of the Soviet industrial empire to themselves for free, and we would describe these things, and we would use this sort of unemotional language. And it occurred to me that if you're writing about something that's outrageous, and you don't write with outrage, that's deceptive. That you're lying to your readers when you do that, and that you have to find a way to summon the appropriate emotional reaction to the material. And I think it's something you have to work at. That's why I told that story about when I got assigned to write this book. I was sort of going through the motions at that point. Before that, it had become a purely intellectual, professional exercise for me to sort of write about this stuff. But it wasn't until, I heard that story about that kid who got stuck in the squad car all day long, and I thought about that over and over and over again. And you just have to stay in touch with that, and it's important to do that. I mean, I think people can be lulled to sleep by a false impression that everything's cool if they don't see a sense of alarm in television and in newspaper coverage.
So after you left the Moscow Times, you helped found a really subversive publication called The Exile, which sort of mercilessly attacked Russian officials and others. What would the Mav Taibbi of then say to the Vladimir Putin of now?
Well, Vladimir Putin was in office during the last couple of years when I was at The Exile, and we were actually more upset not with Putin back then, but with the American reporters who were enabling him. There was this has all been lost in history now, but when Putin came up through the ranks, he was thought of as a friend of the United States. People thought that he was going to be a continuation of the Yeltsin presidency. Yeltsin, of course, was basically a patsy for the United States government, and Putin, being his handpicked successor, was thought of. They would use terms like technocrat to describe him. I remember particularly there was a New York Times story that talked about his past as a KGB agent, and they went into this whole thing about how the KGB actually wasn't that bad of an organization, and that in the Leningrad of the 1970s, where Putin grew up, it was just it was a cool career choice for a young man of talent and intelligence. And they made all these excuses for this guy, who not only had been a KGB agent, but had basically been a bagman for one of the most corrupt mayors in the history of Russia, which is saying a lot. And we were very, very upset about the fact that the American press was all over this person. But what would I say to him now? I mean, look, he's been horrible. I was personal friends with a couple of journalists who are no longer with us because of Vladimir Putin. The journalists like Anna Politkovskaya. There was another one named Yuri Shekachikin, who both sort of met with violent ends for writing things about the Putin administration. Putin, he's a difficult character to sort of sum up easily because in some ways he's a bit of a hero to the ordinary Russian person because he represents standing up to the West. He represents keeping Russia's wealth in Russia, which he did achieve on some level. You know, during the Yeltsin years, the Russian capital was flying out of the country and ending up in Swiss banks, and the Russian people were suffering. So he's a complicated character, but I think he's morphed into a classic Russian strongman, and that type has reappeared over and over again in Russian history, and it's almost never a good thing.
So I don't know if it was the sort of failure to criticize Putin properly, but there was a kind of infamous story in your past of Pine, the New York bureau chief in Moscow
with the
pie.
That story. Yeah.
With some horse semen in it. But you also followed John Kerry around in a gorilla suit during 2004. You've kind of done these very gonzo stunts, and I'm wondering when you feel that's effective, appropriate, like what's the sort of situation that rises to that need to do that?
Well, look, I mean, back when we were doing The Exile, our entire mission was just to be as crazy as possible and to do everything. There was a guy once who walked across the United States backwards. He started, I think, in New York and made it all the way to California. And that was sort of that was the concept of The Exile, is we were going to do everything a newspaper did except in reverse. Like the corrections would refer to things that had never been in the newspaper. Every single part of the paper was a goof on journalism when we were trying as hard as we could to be ridiculous and absurd. We even did once purely out of spite and indifference to the wishes of our advertisers, we did a whole issue in French, and it was bad French too. And we just thought we were young kids, just sort of experimenting with what you can do with the medium. There is an element of journalism. I think you do have to also be able to sell a story in addition to being good at telling a story. And there's the ability to be self-promotional and to bring salesmanship to a subject. It is important. I mean, I don't think it's so necessary to use a gorilla suit anymore. But like for instance, the vampire squid thing. That sort of language and creating a persona and a narrative voice that people could connect with, that's important. That's the difference between a story that people will read and one that people won't read. And you do have to know how to do that, how to get attention when you need to.
I'm just going to pause for a second to tell folks that we're going to be getting to live questions in about 5 minutes. So if you have something to ask Matt, you want to formulate your question, line up at the mics in the back, and a reminder, especially to San Franciscans, that we're looking for a single one-part question, no lengthy setups, no multi-part questions, no speeches, but Matt will be excited to take questions from the audience. Coming out of our discussion of sort of combining theater and performance and a political critique, I'm wondering what your kind of takeaway of how the Occupy movement dissipated. If you're to go back and sort of, okay, this is what happened there, do you have a single takeaway?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I thought Occupy was great. It was unexpected. It was organic. It developed out of thin air. It wasn't the creation of some foundation that decided that it was going to force an issue somewhere. People just came out into the streets and they gathered. And initially, I was critical of the fact. I wasn't critical. I was disillusioned by the fact that there wasn't a single coherent goal of Occupy. But over time, I thought actually that became a strength of the movement because people just sort of came out and they were expressing their general dissatisfaction with something. It was important that we all kind of recognize that there's something wrong with them, with our society, and that I think that was cool. But to me, the failure of Occupy had a lot to do with the people who was coming out to protest. I remember going to a foreclosure court in Jacksonville, Florida, and watching. So I would go into there's this little room where they were a judge sat, and this attorney who had been hired by the banks to throw people out of their homes would come in first thing in the morning with a gigantic stack of folders. You know, he was like Dagwood with the sandwich. You know, it was like all, you know, like accordioning this gigantic pile of folders. And each one of those folders represented a family that was going to be thrown out of their houses that day. And there was such pure rage in that room of, you know, people who were losing their houses. And those people weren't the people protesting at Occupy. And I think if you could combine the people who were the real victims of the financial crisis and of the crime and the misdeeds and the people who came out on Occupy, then I think you'd have something really dangerous. But they never managed, I thought, to reach all of those people.
As a reminder to our radio audience, this program is presented by Inforum, the Commonwealth Club's Innovation Lab. You can find out more about Inforum and its upcoming events at InforumSF on Twitter and Facebook. Tonight, we're hosting Matt Taibbi, a scathing portrait of American injustice. I'm Clara Jeffrey, the co-editor of Mother Jones. And I'm here with Matt Taibbi, former contributing editor for Rolling Stone and author of The Divide, An American Injustice in the Age of the Wealth Gap. We're now going to take questions from the audience, so I'll go to your question first.
Thank you. Thanks. Okay, thanks. So, Matt, you started off talking about a disconnect in the definition of a moral hazard between the people working at the banks and the homeowners who are affected by the crisis. And I'm wondering if you found anything in your research as that would be the root cause of that disconnect. Like, are there really bad people at the top that just don't care about anyone else, or is it more of an issue of ignorance? Like, it's not happening to them, so they just don't know about anything else that could happen to, you know, maybe someone who's not in their position.
No, that's a really good question. I think, by and large, the people I know, a lot of people who work on Wall Street, and most of them are really good people, and a lot of them go into the business for really good reasons, and for the old-fashioned reason. They want to marry capital to good ideas and create jobs, and they want to make a lot of money doing it. But you know that they do have some good motives. But there's a problem with the modern financial services sector, which is that it's very easy to become insulated from the rest of the world. And a lot of these people who were putting together these deals, especially these subprime mortgage deals, you're sitting up in a 37th floor office in lower Manhattan, and you're selling $1 billion worth of bogus mortgages to some pension fund in, you know, say the state of Minnesota. In reality, you're robbing old people of their life savings, but you don't know that. You don't see that. You know, I mean, you're not going to see the results of that transaction. And it's very easy just to see the results for your own life, which is an enormous bonus, and to cut yourself off psychologically from the real world consequences. And I think a lot of people just didn't know. They either didn't know or they didn't care. Either one is bad. Thank you.
So going back to the Holder memo, which you talked about at the beginning, do you blame Eric Holder at all for how it was interpreted, or do you think it was just accidental? And also, do you think his somewhat recent reforms of federal prisons have worked to address some of the problems you brought up?
Well, I can't speak to the recent reforms of federal prisons because I haven't looked into that too much. But in terms of blaming Eric Holder, here's my answer to that. I think collateral consequences is totally reasonable once. Like if you're talking about a company like HSBC, for instance, which has admitted to laundering $850 million for Mexican and South American drug cartels, and you invoke collateral consequences as a reason why you have not criminally prosecuted this company or any of its executives, that's fine. It's one of the world's biggest banks, and God knows what would have happened if you moved against that bank. But as a condition of that settlement, and this is something that Neil Borowski, the former TARP inspector, this is the point that he made to me, as a condition of that settlement, you have to say to that company, you have to break up. You have to get smaller so that the next time you do this, we can prosecute you. And that's what they haven't done. They've invoked collateral consequences as an excuse over and over again, whether implicitly or explicitly. But they've never gone so far as to say to the companies, we're not going to let you get away with this the next time. And I think that's a major, major problem.
Sir?
Hi, my name's Peter Gisella. In your book, you mentioned the American psyche and how it's complacent with this divide. And I was wondering if you are aware of any catalysts, or will you be exploring them in your new job, that could wake up the American psyche and move us in a better direction?
I mean, that's a difficult question. I think one of the problems that's underlying this whole phenomenon is this obsession that we have with success and wealth in this country, and that permeates our entire society, and it's in every media message that we see. You know, that you should be making lots of money, you should be skinny, you should be well-dressed, you should have perfect teeth, and if you don't have a job and you need help, you're a burden to society and you're a loser, and all of these things have become part of the way we look at the world. We've just lost our sense of compassion for other people. It's become uncool to talk about being compassionate to your neighbor, and we've become almost developed a sort of sociopathic way of looking at the world, where all we're really concerned about is ourselves and how much money we're going to make and what we can get, and that's a terrible way of looking at life, and it's the emotional poverty of it is terrible. And I don't know what the solution to that is, but I think it has a lot to do with the media. I think it has a lot to do with the pressure that we all feel to succeed. And it has a lot to do with the fact that a lot of us don't have a lot of... I mean, there's economic pressures that the middle class never felt before, and as a result, there's fear and there's terror, and this is expressing itself as hostility towards people who don't have money. And I don't know. I don't know what the answer to it is, but I think it's a serious problem.
Let's take your question. Hi, Matt. Thank you so much. It's an honor to hear you speak.
I've followed
you for a long time. My name is Cami Kitchen, and I'm a recent transplant from the Midwest. And I'm sorry, Claire, but a rhetorical question. Just I'm going to follow up on that great, compassionate note. A rhetorical question, Matt, how do you not punch people in the face that you write about? but seriously, don't answer that. Short of a revolution, short of a parliamentary system or some other radical departure from the status quo, what are your thoughts on how to pull us back from this brink of the Great Divide? Serious practical solutions that could actually be implemented by agreement from all sides, for example, not deporting all Republicans.
Well, you know, it's funny. I guess people would describe me as being politically, you know, from the left, you know, progressive. But as I've covered the story, I've actually become more and more of a capitalist. And I think the shortest, the greatest shortcut to fixing all of these problems would be letting bad companies go out of business. And that's something that we didn't do in 2008, and we now have this system of an implied government backing for all of these corrupt companies. And I think the moment that we remove that implied bailout of all these firms and we allow corrupt companies to go out of business the way they should go out of business, that Wall Street will reform itself very quickly because there's right now there's no incentive for these companies to clean up and behave better and be better citizens because they don't have to. And I think that's the fastest way that we can fix the problem. That's why I'm so hopeful about this whole too big to fail issue in the Senate, or maybe even it might happen by virtue of the next settlement that's imposed by the Department of Justice. I mean, they can do that without Congress. So that's what I'm really hoping for.
Hi, Matt. Why do you think most financial journalists, especially establishment financial journalists, are more likely to be lapdogs than watchdogs?
That might be a harsh characterization, but I think
at the New York Times.
Well, look at who DealBook is funded by. I mean, DealBook is funded by Goldman Sachs. So, I mean, that's one of their major sponsors. So, what do you expect? One of the classic problems of the financial press is that it is not written for general audiences. For decades, nobody was interested outside of people who were actually involved in the financial services industry. Nobody read the finance pages. Nobody read the Wall Street Journal. And so the people who wrote in those sections of the newspapers, they wrote in heavy, thick jargon, and they wrote for the audiences that were, a very specific, narrow audience. And that's part of the reason why my career took this weird turn, because there was this enormous vacuum. There was it's like before they translated the Bible from Latin into English. it was like there was this whole world out there where nobody had ever explained to the rest of America how the economy worked. I think that's very short-sighted. But what happens is, When you write for a certain audience, you develop a kind of Stockholm syndrome after a while. You develop a kind of simpatico with the people you cover. And this happens in political journalism, and it especially happens in financial journalism. And I'm sure if you watch CNBC, you can practically see the cartoon hearts emanating from the eyes of the anchors when they're interviewing these CEOs. And that's a real problem. Once they start covering the economy for everybody, then we'll have much better coverage of Wall Street.
Okay.
Quick question. In terms of the moral hazard, if you invert that, you start to think about a kind of a basis of civilization that talks about ill-gotten gains. And what we do here is we have asset seizure, and this is something that you've addressed, but it's always confused me how we don't take the idea of ill-gotten gains and apply it universally to say if you lie, if you cheat, or if you steal, whatever it is that you got from that, we take back. And the idea that that disappears, it actually never disappears. It goes somewhere else. There's the asset seizure auctions. There's an entire economy that kind of re-enables that money. So I'm always confused why ill-gotten gains has this disconnect between high-level ill-gotten gains and low-level ill-gotten gains. We agree with the concept, and we see it as a fundamental basis of our society, but we don't distribute it equitably.
Well, that's a really good question. The one point I want to make that I would like to make in response to that is there is a tremendous inequity in terms of how we deal with restitution for ill-gotten gains and for fraud. If you ask any single mom on welfare who has been charged with over-receiving her check, maybe she got $800 too much and she forgot to give it back to the state. Well, guess what percentage of restitution that person is going to pay back to the state? It's going to be 100% every single time. For a certain kind of offender, the restitution is always 100%. But in these high-level settlements involving these big companies, if the settlement is $1 billion, you can bet there was a $30 billion profit. And I don't understand why it is that the person who can't afford to pay 100% restitution has to pay 100%, while the company that can afford to pay 100% and should pay 100% doesn't. That doesn't make any sense to me at all, and I think that's a major inequity, and that's something that should be addressed definitely.
Okay, so we're on radio time here, so it's time for our last question, an informed tradition, which is to ask all the speakers the following. Matt, what is your 60-second idea to change the world?
Wow, that is a really tough one. But I think in terms of this issue, in terms of injustice in the inequities in the criminal justice system, the one thing that I think would change a lot is if people who were arrested on frivolous charges, if they all fought. I think one of the reasons why prosecutors go after the weak and they don't go after big companies is because they know they're not going to encounter resistance when they go after poor people. If poor people, I mean, unfortunately, it might require sitting in jail and awaiting trial, but if they fought it out and they filed motions and they did all the things that rich people did, I think it would give the state pause when they made those decisions. And I think it's important for people to recognize that this is going to be a political movement, that they're going to have to start fighting these cases in order to get their rights back.
Okay, thank you so much. Let's give a big round of applause to Matt Taibbi. And now this meeting of Inforum and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.